welcome Representative Hunt this morning. Thanks for being here. And we're just informational hearings today, and so we'll start off with Bruce Warner and Paul Mather, please.
Good morning. How are you?
Welcome, Paul.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as you indicated, I have with me to your right and my left is Paul Mather, who is the Region 3 manager out of the Roseburg area, who's really been honchoing our bridge issues and trying to help us with solutions there. So I'm going to be turning it over to him in a moment. And I don't want to go without introducing Rachel Knowles on keyboard and mouse, who will be actually moving the presentation forward as I talk. Again, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about the transportation needs. And I think it's important to note that we're here with our partners, the cities and the counties, because it is a system. It doesn't work with one portion of the system falling apart. And we're going to talk mainly today about the roads, streets, and highway portion of the system. And I just remind you that, you know, the transit and the rail, passenger rail and freight rail are also a very important part. And obviously we're not going to talk about that this morning, but I'd be glad to come back and give you some further information if you like in that. So real quickly, I believe you have the PowerPoint presentation in front of you. We'll just go through it right now. Just going to tee up the speakers for you this morning. The Oregon road system, the first graphic on page 2, shows that, as an example here, there is a large network of highways and roads throughout the state of Oregon, 7,500 miles of which are under the control of the state. The way we like to characterize it, it's about 10% of the actual road mileage, but it carries a little over 60% of the actual traffic throughout the state of Oregon. The county roads, you see 27,300 miles of county roads, and these are the roads that really do get folks around from one portion of a county and one region of the state to another, dealing with farm to market, and that is extensive network, and you can see the number of miles there. And then city streets, 9,200 miles. And then finally, I wanted to call your attention that there's 6,500 county, city, and state bridges in the system, which are of great importance to all of us. The next slide was just meant to show you that there's been a number of analyses done over the years to just quantify what we really need to do to properly operate, maintain, preserve, and deal with the expansion needs of the street and highway system of the state of Oregon. And in 1993, the report showed at that time we needed about $1.9 billion for that biennium that started in 1993 to really address all of the needs. And then in 1999, your own legislative fiscal office updated that amount and showed that really in 2003-2005 we needed about $2.6 billion to deal with all those facets of the surface transportation system. The message here is if you look at that, that's about $1 billion a year gap, and I think you've seen some of the numbers that support that. And I think the other important thing this graphic shows is that the gap is growing. And I think there's other reasons for that. The next slide is just meant to show you that in the last session passed House Bill 2142, the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, and this provided $400 million initially, and then that was later changed to $500 million. Actually leveraged in total about $650 million worth of money for the state of Oregon. But it's important to know we went out with a solicitation based on criteria that you folks gave us and additional criteria we put in and wanted to make sure that we selected projects which were ready to go, had no environmental or land use hooks that would prevent them from moving forward. So we said, give us your best projects. And just in a very short solicitation, we had over $1.5 billion worth of requests for that $400 million worth of dollars that were out there. And I just wanted to show you in this where the funds were actually allocated and just the requests of those high-priority, ready-to-go projects from cities, counties and state were, and obviously we couldn't address all of those. The good news is we were able to address about another $150 million of that with the subsequent OTIA 2, as I call it, you folks gave us authority, and some of the local dollars. The next slide is just meant to, and I think this is a profound grasp of the obvious, but inflation is clearly an issue that we need to talk about because a dollar in 1990 costs, what we bought for a dollar in 1990 now costs us about $1.32 just based on inflation. And that's, the average rate is not quite 3% in terms of inflation on the construction and consumer price index. And if you look at the state of Oregon's revenues between the state and federal sources, and you include that 2.75% inflation in there, that means that we lose about $17.2 million a year of buying power with just due to inflation. So that equates to about 7/10 of one penny of a gas tax generated at the state level. And the buying power is going down. I just wanted to stress again that it's made up of things like wages. Obviously, that's a component. But materials, people don't think about this. The liquid asphalt, which is part of asphaltic concrete, last year the price went up 44% on that component of the system. And that doesn't mean that the price of asphaltic concrete went up 44%, because liquid asphalt is just a component of it, but it obviously drives up the cost, and that's the reason you start seeing the increases. Engineering costs really related to wages and cost materials, but right away is the other major factor that we have to deal with. And in many cases, many of our urban modernization projects, we're adding capacity. Actually, it costs more for right away acquisition than it actually does for the cost of the construction of the project, and that's becoming a more and more costly part of the system. The other thing I wanted to talk about is rising fuel efficiency, and I know the Road User Finance Task Force that was set up by the legislature in the last session has tackled this, but this graphic is just meant to show you that in 1970, the average fleet of cars was getting about 11.8 miles per gallon. In year 2000, that's gone up to 19.6 miles per gallon, and that obviously has an impact on the amount of gasoline consumed, which is good from the environmental standpoint, but it isn't good when you look at the road maintenance needs and coupling that with inflation. The next slide is just meant to say that if you look at the impact of inflation plus fuel mileage increases on the Oregon and national fleet, you can see that in actuality, a person driving today is paying about half of what they were paying in 1970 in terms of real dollars on a per mile basis for maintaining, preserving, and expanding the system. The next graphic is right out of that Road User Fee Task Force, which showed that the very bottom line is the actual revenues we are deriving from all of our sources of revenue here at the state. And the other two, the middle line was meant to show it didn't assume an increasing fleet. In other words, everybody was getting the mileage they did in 1970. There's the type of revenue that we have. So it went from almost not quite $400 million today all of a sudden to almost $850 million is what we would have if the mileage had not changed. And then the last line up above is just showing the impact of inflation. So you can see that those two things alone really do impact the ability to address some of the needs. I thought it was important to also show you on page 9 is that obviously with all of the demands, one of the main reasons is the population of the state continues to grow. Growth is occurring. From 1989 to 1999, there was an 18% increase in population. And if you can see down below, the actual increase in number of passenger vehicles registered in the state of Oregon actually increased at a greater rate than the population. So you can see that increased almost 27%. I think that turning to the next slide, something that's very interesting is actually you look at the vehicle miles traveled, in other words, how many miles people travel on a system. That has actually increased 28%, and that's actually, I think, leveled off some, which is also a good piece of news for us. The thing that I think gets everybody's attention is when you look at those growth rates of population and traffic, that compare that to lane miles or new roadway miles added to the system, and you can see that over that same time period, there's been only a 2% increase in road miles statewide. And I think that's even more optimistic or more better looking than it really is, because most of those 2%, I would submit to you, are probably local subdivision streets that were built as really just for access to particular developments and really have not dealt with some of the countywide or statewide or interstate needs of the state of Oregon. And there is an impact to that. And this slide is just meant to show that in that same time period, The congestion levels on our freeway system in the state of Oregon have increased 41%. That is to say that 41% more miles of the interstate are actually seeing congestion. And those of you from the Portland area know what kind of congestion I'm talking about, but that's the congestion you're starting to see in more and more miles of the system, and that's probably going to continue. And in fact, honestly, we're planning for a lower level of service in most cases than what we have today. So I'm going to conclude here with just some additional challenges. I'm going to actually start from the bottom and work up. And I think the bottom three of this really relate to a number of issues that we need to deal with in terms of just making sure that our projects, when we move them forward, are done in an environmentally sound manner to deal with some of the issues. Between Water Quality and Endangered Species Act requirements, we've become much more attuned to needs of just the quality and quantity of runoff coming from our roads, and we're doing a whole bunch of things different. The Endangered Species Act has obviously limited when and where we can do work to protect those salmon and steelhead runs. And one of the other things that we've determined is that one of the major impediments upstream migrants going to spawn and downstream juvenile fish getting back to the ocean is the culverts that all of the jurisdictions have put in underneath roadways and highways over the years. And one of the things we're finding out is we replace culverts, we're also trying to upgrade them to make sure that they're fish friendly. And in fact, we are allocating a small amount of dollars to just retrofit culverts to open up new passages. And we have some real success stories if you want to get into some of those sometime. The final thing is the very top one. Aging infrastructure. I think it's important to note that our infrastructure is aging. Bridges are one of those components, which I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Mather here in just a moment. But again, my message to you is it is a system. Bridges are one of those components that tie together all the systems, because we have one bridge fail. I think you're seeing in Eugene and other places the impacts on the other portions of the system can become dramatic, and we put the traffic on roadways where it was never envisioned before. And I think Representative Byard noted the number of trucks on I-5 this morning, and I just imagine those, if I-5 was not able to carry those trucks, the impact it would be on the various communities around the state. So with that, I think I'm going to conclude, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Unless you have some questions, I'd like to actually just turn it right over to Paul and get into the bridge report.
I have a couple questions, Bruce. Do you have any kind of figure or any way of telling what the land use and laws and environmental laws increase the cost of a project? I realize it had to vary from one job to another.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. Actually, the legislature's asked us that question about twice in the last two sessions. We've actually put together a report that outlines the impact of that from the agency-wide. It's not broken down on an individual project-by-project basis because, as you point out, they're different. I don't have the number at my fingertips, but I'd be glad to get you that report. There's an executive summary, I think, outlines that very clearly from both environmental regulations at the federal and state level, but also the land use regulations.
And do you have any, I'm sure you do, over the last 20 years, the new lane miles added to the state highway system, or 25 years, has there been any?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's been very little. Frankly, we've added a lot of improvements where we've added turn lanes, truck passing lanes. I don't have those numbers at my fingertips, but I think in the overall scheme of things, as an example, at last 10 years, the 2% that was shown there, as I said, majority of that, I'm sure, is local government additions of roads, not the state of Oregon. But I can sure get that number for you. And I think we probably track that. Do we not? I think we can get that for you very quickly.
In the Portland metropolitan area, has there been many lane miles added up there? When you drive up there nowadays, it doesn't seem like there's been any in the last 25 years.
The system is, Mr. Chairman, the system is basically as it's been for about the last 20 years. There have been improvements. We are doing many, spot improvements. Like on Highway 217, however, we did, if you've driven that roadway, actually add auxiliary lanes between the interchanges, which provide additional capacity and help that roadway move ahead. The Sunset Highway, in this year, in fact, we'll be doing some major widening of that facility, and in 2004 doing more. But those are really the first real freeway or highway expansions we've done in a number of years in that area, if I'm answering your question.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Byard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I was looking at the highway fuel revenue chart and the increase in vehicles chart, and I'm assuming all these lines on the highway fuel revenue chart were based on, factored into the number of, the increase in vehicles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, that is correct, yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, you mentioned that the efficiency of the cars have doubled in mileage almost, but we've increased more automobiles. Is that a wash now? Have we increased enough automobiles on the road that even though the efficiency has gone up, that you get what I'm trying to get at?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zonier, if I think what we've seen is the increased population, therefore the increased number of vehicles and the number of miles traveled has increased slightly the amount of money available to the Highway Trust Fund. But when you balance it in relation to inflation, it's essentially a flat revenue and it has been for a number of years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
I have two questions. You have on a chart the loss of revenue from inflation and from increased gas mileage, but you don't have in there, you miss an opportunity to take advantage of some quantification of the efficiencies in the process that you've developed. In the visit we did to Region 2, I was talking to the stripers, and they tell me that they're doing their job with exactly the same money they had in 1990, which strikes me. There is some built-in efficiencies in the processes that you're using to do the things you do. Have you ever quantified the extent to which some of this loss in relative revenue from both inflation and from increased efficiency of cars is offset by built-in efficiencies that have come to the process, technological advances or a variety of other things that have happened over that same time period?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, excellent observation. And I don't think we've ever really quantified that other than what, as you pointed out, what we've, because of the lack of new dollars available to either us or the cities or counties, all of us have been forced to be more and more efficient and effective with the monies we have. And I think the telling story is what you just pointed out is that essentially our maintenance budgets have been flat. And essentially, we've been able to, I believe, provide a level of service that the public believes is good. And, in fact, in many cases, been able to provide a greater level of service. So I guess we could go back and look at the amount of money we spent, 10 years ago versus the money we spent about today and look at what we're doing. And that in and of itself would probably be a very good measure of the efficiencies and some of the things we've done to be better. But I don't think we've ever actually bragged about those, if that's what you're suggesting.
And the second question, Paul. There's this increase in cars that you talk about, and there was some talk here the other day about what causes wear on the existing highway. And does that increase in cars only produce new revenue, increase in miles driven only produce new revenue, or is it taking significant wear on the infrastructure compared to before? I mean, is most of the wear problems on the road caused by cars, increasing the number of miles driven cause it, or is it mostly trucks and other kinds of things?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, what we should do is very shortly you're going to see the next version of the cost responsibility study, which outlines the cost responsibility for wear and tear and improvements to the system caused by both heavy vehicles and light vehicles. And what we know is that these studies have done a very good job of identifying the wear and tear responsibilities of each classes of vehicle. Clearly, the more vehicles you have, the more traffic you have, the more impact on the roadway you have. And obviously, trucks are heavier. They do create additional loads on the pavement than cars do, but that's what's been weighted into the study to reflect that. And there's a lot of good work and scientific analysis that's gone in to determine what the wear and tear is. So you've got a double-edged sword. Both the number of vehicles plus the mileage increases the revenues, but it does also reflect itself in additional wear and tear on the system. And I think we have a pretty good way of allocating the cost between heavy and light vehicles, if I'm catching the drift of your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One more question, Bruce. We learned just recently that our bond rating for the state of Oregon has taken a decline. Does that affect bonds that are issued for highway construction?
It would not affect the bonds issued by the state of Oregon that are backed by the Highway Trust Fund. In fact, our rating is still high. I think we now have a better rating than probably the state as a whole. I haven't checked to see where we are, but our rating, to my knowledge, is unchanged.
Thank you. Thank you. Paul?
Oh.
Don't do it, switch.
Okay. I guess he knows how to work the keyboard himself.
Yeah. Good morning. As Bruce said, Paul Mather, Region 3, and also team leader of the Economic and Bridge Options Report. I've asked John O'Shell from Association of Oregon Counties to join us, because this report is really more than just the bridges in the state system. It's really the bridges of the state of Oregon. And as we approach this report, we approach it from that standpoint, as it affects the overall communities of the state as well as the overall economy of the state. And so John's going to kind of chime in at different points to help bring you the fuller picture of the bridge needs of the state. What I want to do this morning is just walk you through the report that we've been working on for the last several months. I'm going to go through some background pieces on bridges and just some briefly how we got here. I want to talk about the freight system and how important that is and the interrelationship between freight and bridges. Talk about some of the things we learned about in the report, those economic impacts, those livability impacts to our communities that we see, and then end with recommendations. As we go through this, there's a lot of material here that I'm going to present. It's fairly complex, interrelated issues. If you have questions as we go through, please stop me just for understanding. As I said, we'll start with background. This is an important slide to kind of keep in mind as we go through the entire presentation. This is a slide that shows the demographics of Oregon bridges and the ages that we have of our structures in the state. On the top, you'll see the gold is the local structures, cities and counties, and the bottom is the blue, the state structures. Typically, a bridge lasts between 50 and 100 years. Many variables contribute to the age of a structure, the amount of traffic, the design, the environmental conditions, numerous things. But typically, a life of a structure is 50 to 100 years. And you can see pretty dramatically on this slide that we have a significant number of the bridges in the state are just entering into that window of 50 to 100 years. What has compounded that or accelerated that in the last several years, what we've learned, we've seen this problem coming for some time, but what has accelerated that for us is a particular design that we used in the late 50s and early 60s during a very intense bridge building effort in the state. We've found cracks in bridges, shear cracks, because of that particular design that was used. Many of the bridges that we've had restrictions on over the last several years, including the one currently in Eugene, is because of that design factor.
Can I ask?
Certainly.
Could you go back? Do you know how to go back also?
Yep.
Oh, good. Which of those bars does that design flaw period cover? Is it the two big bars or just the one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, it's the 40 to 50 year is primarily the one. There also are some bridges in the 30 to 39 year block. As you go to the next slide, this gives you an appreciation of where those bridges are. That's the red dots from around the state. This is the state system of where those bridges that we've identified having a problem with that particular design. The blue dots on here are ones that are posted or restricted in some way today. The data on here is actually a couple months old. There's a couple more blue dots that should be on here that are not, but this gives you some representation of what that looks like.
Well, then all those dots on there, those bridges have some cracking problem there.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. As you turn to the local system, you can see there's still a fair amount of red dots that are on there. The same design was used on the local bridges during the same time period, but you'll see a significant number more that are currently posted. Just to look back for the last 5 years and what we've experienced during the last 5 years. In 1997, we had no emergency repairs, and we had 42 load restrictions on our system. As we turn ahead to 2000, We now see 13 emergency repairs on our system and 49 load restrictions. While that 49 number isn't that much bigger than the 42, what we saw significantly in 2000 is now we see about a half a dozen restrictions on the interstate or major freight routes. The 42 restrictions we had in 97, none of those were on the interstate or major freight routes in the state. As we turn ahead to...
Using the same trucks in all these figures, or the size of the trucks increased at all from 97 to 2001, or are these statistics using the same truck?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The truck weight restrictions or laws have stayed the same during the same time period.
Thank you.
As we turn ahead to 2000, we're projecting by the end of this year that we'll have 140 bridges on the state system restricted. That represents about 5% of state bridges. By the year 2010, that number grows, based on current funding, grows to 850 bridges, or about 30% of our system. Again, that's on the state system. You'll see similar numbers on the city and county side that will reflect these numbers as well. Give you some examples of some of the emergencies that we've seen, and if I had the slide completely updated, you would see the one that was posted just this week in the Eugene-Springfield area. But some of the other ones that are similar to that, both in the local system as well as on the state system. Savvy's Island is a local county bridge that connects Savvy's Island with U.S. 30, critical for the farm-to-market. Savvy's Island. Thank you.
Just keep going.
Just keep going. It's critical for the farmers in that area, as they depend on this bridge for their links to their market. Coles Bridge is another one that gained a lot of notoriety as it restricted access to a mill in John Day. The mill owner in that area said that during the time that bridge was restricted, it was costing his mill $30,000 a day for the extra time it took for the trucks to go on the detour. One that I'm very familiar with in Southern Oregon is Ford's Bridge on I-5. In that case, we actually lowered the restrictions on the freeway down to 64,000 pounds and essentially had the entire interstate truck traffic going through downtown Riddle and downtown Canyonville for about 3 weeks. Created for some very interesting times. Another example, again, the local system is Pine Street Bridge, which is just adjacent to the Central Point Interchange in Southern Oregon. Currently, that bridge has remained closed because of the restrictions. Backing up a little bit, just again for some background, some of you may be familiar with the Bridge Task Force report that was done last spring. It validated the problem that I'm speaking about with the crack bridge problem. It said we need to have an approach that replaced bridges rather than not repair bridges. It's not cost effective to do repairs on these bridges for the weight gains that you're allowed to gain. In most cases, it's better to replace. We need to shift from a worse first. Typically, we've just done the worst bridge, replaced that one, moved down the list to the next one. It said to recognize that in corridors, if you limit a bridge in a corridor, that entire corridor is now limited. So we need to change from a worst first to a corridor approach to gain that sensitivity of how the system is put together from a freight standpoint. And finally, it recommended that we start with the interstate system first, I-5 and I-84. Turning back to last session, you heard Bruce speak about OTEA. OTEA was another major piece in helping us get some of the bridge issues addressed. Nearly $200 million went towards bridges. You can see on the map there, those are the ones that represent on the state system or about on the state system. There's an also additional $60 million or 36 bridges on the local system that were funded. Another key point in this slide is we've seen this problem coming, as I said, over the last 5 years. Our Transportation Commission has made shifts within our program and nearly doubled the size of our bridge program during that time. That has come at the cost of other programs, modernization, maintenance, and preservation to make those shifts. Now we'll shift to the freight side and give you some background on that part of the equation. Oregon's freight system is made up of trucks, rail, water, air as the main components. And as you can see from this graph, trucks are the predominant mode in this state for a variety of reasons. But more importantly on this slide, the blue box there at the top, I think, is the most important point to focus on. Nearly a third of the goods that are shipped on trucks in this state are shipped in trucks that are over 80,000 pounds. To understand a little bit of what that means, this gives you some background about that. The typical interstate truck that you see, the five-axle truck on the interstate system, is 80,000 pounds. When you go above 80,000 pounds, you have two different groups of trucks that we talk about. The first is non-divisible or indivisible loads. Those are your large construction equipment, your bridge beams, those things that you can't take apart to move down the system. And typically they move on a single by a single trip permit as they move down the highway system. The divisible loads, they're at the bottom of the graph. Those are typically represented by trucks with more than five axles, your double trailers, your triple trailers, type combinations. Those are the ones that carry over 30% of the commerce in this state and are critical to the state's economy to reach many of the rural remote areas and make businesses in the state competitive with others in the western United States as well as Canada. Some of the commodities that are shipped in these loads, and again, focusing on the yellow, are those loads that are between 80 and 105,000 pounds. The chemical fuels ores portion, you'll notice, is a fairly large component for these. An example of that, nearly every gas station is served by trucks that come in truck and trailer combinations that are 105 five-pound loads. They load in the terminals in Portland or in Eugene and service gas stations all throughout the state. If we limit, for example, to 80,000 pounds, this entire industry would have to retool to a different configuration of trucks, add more trucks to the highway, hire additional drivers, additional costs that get passed on to consumers at the pump. The next one down, forest lumber and furniture, is another key one, again, to the economy of the state. Many of the remote lumber mills that we have in the state depend on the truck and trailer combinations to move their finished products to market and stay competitive in their marketplace, again, throughout the western United States and in Canada. Where do these heavy loads originate? I think to no one's surprise, you know, the economic engine hub of this state is the Portland area, and this slide shows that these heavy loads by number volume generate out of the Portland metro area. But to see the whole picture, you really need to look at individual economies from throughout the state. And when you take individual economies from different regions, especially eastern, central, and southern Oregon, the percentage that those individual economies are dependent on these 105 five-pound loads is dramatically more than what the Portland metro area is. Again, these rural, remote areas are vitally dependent on getting their agricultural goods, their finished products on lumber, aggregate, big, heavy, bulky products to market. Talk a little bit now about some of the things we learned specifically during the study itself. We have about a $5 billion problem. If we're going to address all the restrictions on our system that we're projecting over the next 10 years and have a system that's completely free of restrictions, the price tag is nearly $5 billion to accomplish that. Without that investment, we're going to see the industry adding additional truck trips as our bridges are limited. As that limit goes down to 80,000 pounds, again, that's going to affect that 30% that we're talking about of our goods that are shipped. As that goes down to 64,000 pounds, then we reach about 90% of the goods that are shipped in the state are now affected. The economic effect that has on our economy is up to $122 billion between now and 2025. The potential job loss that represents is 88,000 jobs. Some perspective to both those numbers. Intel does about $5 to $6 billion annually in the state compared to the $122 billion. On the 88,000 jobs, in the peak of the timber industry in 1978, 81,000 jobs were employed in the industry in 1978, compared to that 88,000 number. These are large, extremely large numbers and significant impacts to the Oregon economy.
Representative Greenlee.
Give me that number again,
please. Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, the numbers, $122 billion, by 2025 compares to Intel, which does an average of about $5 to $6 billion annually. The 88,000 jobs, the timber industry in 1978 employed a total of 81,000 jobs in 1970. I don't have, I don't have that number. It's less than 81,000, but I can tell you the number.
That guy's got his stuff together.
Yeah. again, the regional impacts that I've been talking about throughout the presentation, they're pronounced in the more rural, remote areas of the state. As we found in our model, the Rogue Valley in southwest Oregon has the bulk of the crack bridges, and because of that, they have some of the more severe direct impacts. Central Oregon also, because just where they are geographically in the state, and have to travel large distances just to get to other systems beyond Oregon's borders, are also affected. It's also, though, key to remember that the Portland area is a transportation hub for the state, and many of the rural markets depend on that transportation system to be functioning for their goods, again, to get to market and markets outside of the state of Oregon. We not only have an economic impact, but we also have a community impact. Again, as we're seeing this week, as we have additional trucks going through Junction City and Monroe, we've seen with these other restrictions that we've seen downtowns, neighborhoods affected. We've seen trucks put on roads that aren't designed for trucks. Either their geometry is not designed for them, the pavements aren't designed for them, and again, they go through downtowns by schools and create impacts that the area is not designed to handle. These increase safety in safety risks, as well as increased maintenance costs for the state system as well as the local system as we deal with these detours. To the industry itself, the impacts will be seen in the short term as we have kind of this random escalating restrictions that we have on our system. You're going to see them forced to go to lighter loads. Their costs are going to increase as they have to go on these detours. And again, costs increase that get passed on to consumers. In the long term, firms will be forced to retool their fleets, relocate outside of Oregon, or our model suggests that they may actually work, move to the borders of Oregon and utilize other state transportation systems that serve Oregon. But again, the transportation costs go up and passed on to consumers. I want to move directly into the recommendations that we have in the study. Given the impacts that I've been talking about, our recommendation obviously is to invest in bridges now and minimize the impacts that we're going to have on the economy and the community. We recognize $5 billion is an extremely large number, and we're not going to totally eliminate impacts to the communities or the economy. But we need to begin to head down that road to minimize those impacts. We established four key priorities that we wanted to focus on as we built our recommendation. First, fix the interstate first and keep the trucks on the interstate off the local streets. We need to fix important freight routes that link to the interstate system. We need to fix the economically critical city and county bridges and recognize their importance in this system as they build on this, again, large statewide system. Also need to recognize as we build through this strategy, there's going to be bridges that are not addressed or left for later priorities. We need to develop a funding source that we can do the emergency repairs to keep those bridges functioning for the markets that they serve. Our recommendation is for a staged approach. As we built the study, our assumption was to build it in a time frame that we could get these stages done within 10 years. As we near the end of the study and started to do more investigation on that, we think we can actually get it done in more like 7 years. So we're thinking we can deliver this stage approach in 7 to 10 years. One of the key variables in delivering this approach is some of the environmental restrictions that Bruce talked about earlier in his presentation. But for many of our bridges, we're not able to work on them only during specific in-water work periods, and those happen during specific annual times that limit the times that we're able to do the construction work. Talk a little bit about how we developed our stage approach. We had numerous meetings with freight carriers and key manufacturers. As we talked with these freight users of our system, we also used our statewide economic model and compared what we were hearing from the industry with what our economic model was telling us. We took that information and also compared it to a survey that we did with the city and county bridges to understand which ones were critical to local needs. We also built a model ourselves from the bridge standpoint for every segment of state highway. How much would it cost to get this particular segment from point A to point B repaired or able to handle different sizes of load, whether it was 80,000 pounds, 105.5, or whether it was the single trip permit loads. We combine that information with restrictions that we currently have on our system, whether they're curves, whether they're tunnels, or other restrictions from our motor carriers unit. Combine all that together, and we build through an iterative process the recommendation that you see in our draft report. We presented that draft report to our commission back in January. Received some feedback from them that the interstate system wasn't done soon enough in this stage approach, and they wanted us to go back and look at ways to get the interstate done sooner. We also received feedback that our recommendation in our draft report did not reach enough places throughout the state, and we needed to build a strategy that, that touched or reached more communities through the state. So what I'm going to present to you now is a revised recommendation from what was in the draft report that you may have received online or what was reported or presented to our commission in January. The first stage of our recommendation is Highway 97 from Klamath Falls north to Madras, Highway 26 over Mount Hood from Madras to I-205 in Portland, through Central Oregon from Bend, Ontario via US 20. This route gives us a north-south, east-west connection in the state that links that Portland market. It can also be done within our existing revenue. It's also key to put this in place before we turn to our top priority, which is the interstate. Before we have the interstate under construction, we need a place for trucks to have an alternative place that they can go and use while the interstate is under construction. And this provides that. To give you some breakdown as to the different costs, in that you can see the different highway segments, the amount of bridges that we'll be working on, and the price tags for those. During this process, with the number of bridges that we have in the state, the number of jurisdictions that manage and are responsible for the bridges, we struggled with how to incorporate this into a comprehensive strategy. On the local bridge side, we made some assumptions to put in here that we have not gone back and validated. But we put some assumptions in to at least account for the need on the local side. Our assumption from this on the city side was if an individual stage was going through a city or community, if they had a bridge identified, that was included in the stage. Likewise, on the county side, as we were moving up the highway and reached the bridge that was within 5 miles of the stage, it was included. But again, for planning purposes, that's how we generated these numbers. We need to go back and validate those numbers.
Excuse me, Representative Greenlock, you had a question?
Yeah, this stage one triggers a question in my mind. What proportion of freight traffic comes right through Oregon without essentially stopping? What proportion of it is Washington to California, California to Washington, or east to Washington and east to California? Is it a very, very small proportion?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlock, I don't know that number, and I don't have a good feel for what that number would be. I can do some research on that and get back to you on that.
Stage one really deals with, essentially the through traffic, but it's yeah. Portland through.
Right. Portland. What we tried to deal with in the study is again just provide that link to what was important. Our model was an Oregon model, and what was key to Oregon, and what that model told us is we needed to provide a connection for the Portland market to a north-south, east-west connection to our borders of the state. And to get that within our existing revenue that supported the interstate is how we came up with this recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, I just chatted with my head of my motor carrier folks. We don't have a number right at our fingertips, but the number's large. It's probably 40, maybe even up to 50% of the trucks going on the interstate are going from one part of the West Coast to another.
Moving on in our stage approach, in stage two we turn to our main priority, which is the interstate. In stage two we construct or reconstruct the bridges on I-84 for its entirety. We work on I-5 from I-205 south to Highway 58 just south of Eugene, and we included Highway 58 in this stage. Highway 58 in this stage is critical because, again, a big portion of our needs are in the southern portion of I-5. And 58 provides another key detour link in our system for freight to use while we were reconstructing the southern portion of I-5. Here's some of the attributes of that stage and some of the cost breakdowns. You'll notice this stage is significantly more expensive than the first stage. Moving on to Stage 3. Stage 3 just completes the I-5 corridor from Highway 58 south of Eugene down to the California border. And the schedule cost breakdown of that. And you can see that the two segments in Stage 2 and 3 and I-5 are the significant costs in the entire state or in that I-5 corridor. Moving on to Stage 4, this is where we get to the key freight links that link into the interstate system. Here's a whole series of key freight routes that we identified that link into the system that we've created through the first three stages. One of our priorities was to connect the ports on the coast, starting with Astoria via US 30 and connecting to I-5 at Longview, Newport via Highway 20, Highway 38, and Highway 42. We're connected. We also pick up many north-south connections through Central and Eastern Oregon that are critical for farm-to-market needs in those regions. Most of these routes were picked, again, to connect major economic important places in the state, as well as the route specifics were based on that cost-benefit ratio as we built on our bridge needs list as how costly each segment of our highway was. This gives you, again, some attributes for Stage 4 and those cost breakdowns. You'll notice on here quite a number of the highways, and the costs are significantly less than we saw on the interstate system and the value that these provide. There's also, as we, again, build this network, we are able to link into a series of highways that have no identified bridge needs on them. And for Stage 4, here's a list of highways that have no identified bridge needs that get linked up in the system and become, again, functional from a freight network standpoint. Moving on to Stage 5, we selected, again, a variety of routes around the state to build this network of freight that we're building on. We made a different level of repair on these routes than we had through the first four stages. Through the first four stages, we were rebuilding bridges to accommodate essentially any load on that system. Here, we dropped that down a level, and we don't rebuild these routes to accommodate any load. They only accommodate those 105-pound loads, but they fall short of accommodating those single trip permit loads or those big, heavy loads, construction equipment type loads. The value that we get for a relatively small amount of investment for, again, those rural remote areas, for the lumber mills, for the timber industry, for the agricultural pieces of the rural portion of the state is extremely valuable. Give you a cost breakdown, some attributes of Stage 5 and some cost breakdowns. You'll see that even more so than Stage 4, these routes are significantly more inexpensive, again, because we're not taking them to that full level that we did in Stage 4. And like in Stage 4, there's another series of routes that require no work that get linked up through this network. Moving back a couple slides. So when you get completed with all five stages, this is what your network look like. The first four stages, again, accommodate any load on our system, and the green that's on here, or Stage 5, accommodate the 105.5-pound loads. Again, the one thing we don't want to forget as we put this together, there's still needs outside of this five stage. There's routes that aren't identified, and we need to identify some emergency funds to deal with those structures. What this slide represents is how much that would cost based on where we stopped with our stages. For example, if you did Stage 1 and did no more than Stage 1, our estimates are $800 million for the next 10 years are needed to triage or band-aid together the rest of the system. That number falls to $300 million if you fund the entire five stages. Oops. Just a summary of our approach. Again, those four key priorities are important to us. Fix the interstate, important freight routes, local routes that build that link into the system, and develop a funding strategy for triaging the remainder of the system. Our recommendation is based on funding all five stages. If our funding level falls short of that, we need to go back to these four key priorities and build a different recommendation. Our total package there at the bottom is roughly $2 billion when you put together the cost of the five stages plus the triage funds. In summary of the report, we are going to see an impact on Oregon's economy. And with no additional investment by the year 2025, it's going to be up to $122 billion, or 88,000 jobs potentially lost by 2025. We're also going to see higher transportation costs that are passed on to consumers. We're going to see bridge restrictions that are put in place that harm communities, that trucks are put on roads and put in downtowns by schools in areas that are not designed to handle those volumes of trucks. Our recommendation is based on funding all five stages. And in the report itself, we actually did some work on how much funding the five stages will stimulate the Oregon economy. Our estimates are funding the five stages will generate more than $1 billion in wages. With that, that's the end of my presentation.
Well, the package you talked about here was $2 billion. Where's the other, and we said to start with, the overall problem is $4 to $5 billion. Where's the other $2 to $3 billion at, then? Where's...
Mr. Chairman, our aim in the study was to build a strategy that was affordable and was strategic in how it addressed Oregon's freight needs and minimize the effect on the economy. Obviously, if we put a strategy together that addressed all $5 billion worth of needs, that's not what our goal was in the study, was to come short of that and be more strategic and come with a package that was more affordable.
So this package will leave a lot of bridges unfixed?
Yes, it'll leave a gap between the $2 billion and the $5 billion number that will still be out there. But this $2 billion investment will address the most important bridges on our system and provide triage funds for the next 10 years to get us through the next 10 years to get these bridges built and constructed and then reassess where we're at in 10 years to deal with the remainder of the bridges.
So in 10 years, we'll probably still have the same problem.
Mr. Chairman, yes, this does not address all the problem. It gives us a bite-sized piece that we can deal with during the next 10 years and one that's affordable to us.
Thank you. I'll represent an agreement.
You have a large number of local bridges included in this, and I wonder if you could be specific about the extent to which the Multnomah County bridges over the Willamette are included here and in which stage they're dealt with, and are they all dealt with by the time this package is done?
Chairman Brown, Representative Greenlick, John Oschel, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Let me talk about the local bridge for a moment. It was included in the study. When we came to specifically what were happening, what actually happened in the process of the study is we were adjusting the priority routes rapidly. As we did the study, we have a good comprehensive understanding of what local bridges need to be picked up in order to bring all the commerce to the freight routes. As we went out there, we identified the posted bridges. We identified the bridges with the severe cracking, including the Sovie Island Bridge, just to let you know that's definitely in the mix here. And then we said, these are the ones that we know we need to do. And once again, I think you guys all got the concept. You know, nothing is manufactured on the freight routes. To get the commerce to the freight routes, you've got to have all the other routes also. So you've got to have the whole system. And what we did is we identified this roughly $300 million in local bridges that have to be done to bring the freight to all these routes. Now, in the process of all the shuffling of priorities, at this point, we can't tell you which bridges probably will go with which stages. The idea will be to, as we know what stages are there, then we'll pick the local bridges that best support getting the most commerce to the routes that are open. I mean, a classic of letting you know how fast the list went and so forth, the Sovie Island Bridge is known as one that has to be fixed. If you look at all the routes that were up there, we said, okay, let's grab everything within 5 miles of a route. Well, the Sovie Island Bridge is naturally within 5 miles of one of the routes, so it wasn't on the quick list that were manufactured. I don't think there's anyone out here that is not expecting that Sovie Island Bridge will be one of the ones that need funded. So,
may I follow?
Yeah,
I wasn't thinking of the Sovie Island Bridge, in fact. I think we can figure out how to deal with that one. There are 125 local bridges, and I think your commission was wise in suggesting that there be local projects because you're going to need local political support to move this package. And it's going to be very hard for me to go back to Multnomah County and sell a package for moving freight from Washington to California without stop and go, unless you have in there some, you have some ability for me to talk about the seven or eight bridges across the Willamette, some of which, one of which is railroad, a couple of which are state, but most of which are local. And I was just wondering, are those bridges, are there any of those bridges, not including Selby Island, included in the 125 bridge packages here, or are these just a random 100, I mean, an unspecified 125 bridges?
The bridges that were listed, the list we came up with was by looking at all the local bridges that were posted and cracked, and then we did a quick down and dirty look at each bridge and say, does major commerce flow over this bridge? And if it did, then it is on the list. Now, that was done fast, and we know we need to look at it again, but that is how we came up with this list. It was the bridges that are known to be posted or have severe cracks that we know have major commerce.
May I try one more time, sir?
Okay, sorry.
I'll see if I can express in terms of English.
Yeah.
There are things like the Broadway Bridge, the Markham Bridge, the Fremont Bridge, the Morrison Bridge. There are bridges, and they're actual specific bridges. My question is, are any of those bridges in this package? Not how did you get to this package, okay, not how many bridges there are, not how much money did it cost. The question is, and am I going to go back into Washington County and say, we need to really support this because this will fix the Burnside Bridge and the Broadway Bridge, or to say it won't fix the Burnside Bridge and the Broadway Bridge? So I have a very simple question here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, none of those bridges are in the report.
Okay.
On the state system side, the need on the Markham and the Fremont, there's not a need on either one of those bridges.
Thank you.
Representative Donner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've created the problem. We know what it is. Now the next part of the sales job is to solve it. So where are we going to get the money? Any ideas?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, obviously we're having discussions with a number of you about how we solve this problem. I think the governor has outlined fairly forcefully that he believes we should look at increasing vehicle registration fees and title fees as a way to fund this package. We've actually done work and determined that if we had about $87.1 million of new revenues, which before the last cost allocation say was about exactly equal to the amount that was generated by increasing the vehicle registration fee $15 and having a commensurate weight mile or truck heavy truck fees increased to pay their fair share. We took that amount of money, took some of the dollars that we currently spend on bridges along with some of the money that's currently being spent by the cities and counties on bridges, and bonded that. We could come up with between $1.6 and $1.7 billion to solve this first five stages of the report that's identified here, and then the remaining $300 million would essentially be covered out of existing bridge resources that we spend about right now about $80 million a year of our normal funds on bridges. So you can see that we'd have $60 to $70 million left of where we could deal with that triage that Mr. Mather's talking about for the next 10 years. Was that direct enough for you, Mr. Zahner?
Well, yeah, just a follow-up on that. What's the total of that first amount that you'd like to get bonded? You said $87 million, but then you added some more, and what's that total amount?
Well, the total amount on an annual basis to come up with that $1.6 to $1.7 billion worth would be the $87.1 of new state resources plus $25 of annual resources from existing state and federal sources that we now currently collectively spend on bridges.
Okay. Thank you.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Okay.
That's it. Right. John,
I'm up next. Everybody take a deep breath. We're going to do a topic change.
Thank you.
Change a few people.
Bruce, Paul.
We'd like to talk to you for a while now about maintenance and preservation of the system. This is basically one of those basic things that's out there. Every poll that is ever taken that says, do you think we ought to maintain what we have before we spend money on new projects, the people always say yes.
But when you actually get to talking about spending money, it's one of those ones that is so obvious that it needs to be happening, so blatantly clear that it needs to be happening, that no one realizes they need to pay for it. And so, as a result, when people start talking funding package, we talk about these high-priority modernization projects for capacity, and we talk about the bridge projects, and we fund them by eating into our maintenance funds. What I want to show you today is to really bring out the issues associated with what happens if you don't do the basic maintenance. Understanding that right now about half the maintenance needs are being funded in this state. We are way behind the curve, and we can't get any further behind the curve. What I'm going to do as far as the presentation, John Harris, who's a City Gresham Transportation Supervisor, is going to talk to you a little bit about some of the efficiencies we've been doing. This was referred to earlier that, you know, when we've had basically flat funding for 10 years, the way we've kept up many of the services have been by efficiencies. He's also going to give you a presentation to show you what is the impact economically of not getting to those preservation projects soon enough. I'll then come back and talk to you about all those myriad of little maintenance things that they're so obvious that you don't realize that you're paying for them, but we're out there doing them. And then close with what are the economic impacts of if we don't do the maintenance. So, John?
Okay, thank you. Did you like that? Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to come speak to you today. As John said, I'm John Harris, Transportation Operations Supervisor for the City of Gresham. Just a little background, real quick. We have 220 miles of roadways that we maintain in the city and a staff of 13, plus some seasonal help to assist us in that. And over the last few years, as you know, as revenues have fallen or stayed flat, I should say, we have had to try and stretch our dollar any way that we possibly can and have been pretty creative and pretty successful to a point. And some of those things I wanted to point out. One is the contract sweeping. Several years ago, our sweeper was in need of replacement, and we went out to bid and found out that it was cheaper for us to have a vendor provide that service rather than replacing the $120,000 to $150,000 piece of equipment. And we're now in the fifth year of that contract. It also allowed us to free up one staff person, about 1,600 person hours each year, to provide necessary work out there in the street. One of the key emphasis in our program, of course, is preventive maintenance. And one of the first maintenance activities that we usually do is crack sealing. As a road starts to age, and I'll show you some of that later on, one of the first signs of distress is cracks in the street, which leads to rapid deterioration if water is able to penetrate the pavement. So this is used to be provided by us, and again, we found that to be a cheaper service to have on the private side to do for us. Next on the list of treatments after that, after crack seal, would be a slurry seal treatment, which is a thin coating that refreshes the pavement surface, adds a little bit of wear life to it, adds, and can prolong that surface by about 5 to 7 years each time we apply that treatment. We've also taken advantage of the correction crews in Multnomah County to provide some of the simpler services that are cheaper for us to have them do it. We get a crew of about 8 to 16 people, and for a charge of $400 a day, they will trim vegetation, pick up trash, clean the sides of the roadways. Found that to be a lot less expensive for us.
Hate to interrupt.
Pardon me.
How do the residents feel about the convicts going through the neighborhood? Do you get any complaints on the inmate work crews?
To my knowledge, I've only had one.
Okay.
We alert the public too that the correction crews will be in the neighborhood, either on our website or some mailings, or through neighborhood association notices. Another innovative way that we have taken advantage of stretching the dollar is partnering with several other agencies. Years ago, back in 1995-96, I believe, we partnered initially with ODOT and Multnomah County to share equipment in emergency services. If we had a flood or landslide or problem like that, well, that evolved into why not just share the equipment? You know, these things are very expensive. We don't use them all that often. Some of the specialized pieces of equipment, let's share resources and trade off. So we've been doing that quite successfully for the last many years, and in fact have added I think six or seven other local agencies. We're also part of an umbrella group with the folks across the river in Clark County in Southwest Washington, and also the Washington County cooperative. And here you see a picture of Clackamas County providing a rubberized chip seal for us on a couple of our busier streets. A former ODOT director had a quote that I liked, and that was that if you don't know what you're doing, you can't get there. If you can't itemize, I guess. One of the things that we do is utilize a pavement rating system, a pavement management system. In this particular case, it's one that's used by a lot of local agencies and also down in California and Washington. And it rates pavement on a scale of 1 to 100, with the highest being the best condition and the lowest obviously being the worst. It assists us with our planning program for our preventive maintenance system program that we have each season, and allows us to predict, most importantly, what the future street conditions will be over time. And we have found by putting a great deal of time and effort into rating this, we do know exactly what we have out there, and it has come to pass on the predictive deterioration of the roads. And as a result, we've had to use the money as wisely as we can, and have found that the dollar is more effectively spent by preserving the roads that are in good shape rather than waiting for them to get bad and taking care of the worst ones first. I'll demonstrate that in the next slide here. As pavement ages on a local street, as a typical example, they last about 30 years. The road holds up quite well for about the first 15 years, as you can see, there a 40% drop in quality. But during the next 3 to 5 years, it drops another 40%. So at the end of about almost 18 to 20 years, 80% of the road life is gone. We all drive cars, and we all know what good roads and bad roads look like, but sometimes we don't know how they deteriorate, and that question came up earlier. One is load, one is environmental. Many other types of distresses can show up in a pavement. This slide demonstrates one of the failures that we typically have to repair. It's called alligator cracking. And the key element to this one is that the distress starts at the bottom of the asphalt, and by the time it comes up to the surface, it's much worse than it would appear. The road has deteriorated from the bottom up.
Is that a...
Pardon.
I apologize. I'm used to... got used to interrupting on my own. I apologize.
I'm getting used to you, too, John.
Thank you. Is that perhaps due to not having a good, solid subsurface base of the road originally that would cause the damage from underneath, moisture from the ground and those kind of things?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mabry, I used to work as a soils consultant, so we had a lot of elements in road construction that we had to emphasize. And every part, every component of that is really, really critical. You have to have a good solid base. That's the soil, then the base rock itself, and then the asphalt. And any of those things can vary. If water is able to penetrate, that could be a problem. If it's poorly compacted, if there's inadequate section, if the road design was not thick enough, for example, for the anticipated loads, if the rock is not 12 inches, for example, and it turns out that they had designed it for 8 inches in thickness, it could be a variety of causes. What one of our pet phrases, though, around the office is that water is the enemy. Once the road cracks and water gets in, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion. This next slide demonstrates our preventive strategy that we try to implement and have been pretty successful in the last few years. It shows that as a road deteriorates, it needs a preventive maintenance on a periodic basis, and that is typically the crack seal that I mentioned that goes down first, and then the slurry seal. Those are done at 5 to 7 year intervals if everything goes according to plan. And then at the end of 30 years, an overlay is applied to that road. That keeps the road in top condition. As you can see, it's a type 1 classification, which is the best category. And the overall cost at the end of expenditures, I believe, would be about $20 over that 30-year period, $20 per square yard. If we were not to maintain that road and let it deteriorate to where it needs to be completely reconstructed, it would cost almost twice as much. And in of course, during that interval, the road would be deteriorating all the way down. So it would be a failed situation, an unpleasant road condition. This is an example of a PCI value of 100 where the road is new, it's an overlay, or a fresh pavement. It will not need any attention from us for 5 to 7 years. This is a road that is a good slurry seal candidate. It's still in good condition. Its structural base is sound. It's got a little cracking. We would either seal some of the cracks or remove some of them if they're in bad shape and then apply the slurry seal and not need to attend to that road for another 5 to 7 years. This is a road with a condition of PCI value of 50. It needs an overlay, but before the overlay were to occur, we'd remove some of the failed sections. But it would require minimal preparation. Same with this one. This needs an overlay. I don't know if you can see this very well, but this road has failed. It has structural failure. Either the road base that was put down was inadequate for the ultimate load and design life, or the road has just gone too far without any maintenance. So it would need to be completely reconstructed, and that means removing the asphalt, the base rock, recompacting the subbase, starting going up. Our current PCI, the one that the council has asked us to maintain, and we've done fairly well so far, is a condition of 73 to about 75. And you can see on this chart, in 2002, we had a PCI of 73. That means most of the average road is in good condition. In 2003, it's dropped a little bit because we weren't able to do as many projects as we had wanted. And then this is a projection with the pavement management system that we use. What will happen under a variety of scenarios? We currently have $150,000 available for preventive maintenance. That's the slurry seal, the crack seal, the overlay, that type of work. If that funding scenario continues out to 2021, we will have a PCI value of about 38, which is basically a potholed gravel road. We looked at a couple of funding scenarios, what would happen if we were able to spend what the system told us was the appropriate amount of money, and had two of them. One was $3.6 million and the other $4 million per year for preventive maintenance. Both systems, both scenarios would keep that PCI value up and the average road condition in good shape. And you're probably wondering, what's the difference in the different funding levels? The difference is the what we call the deferred or the backlog of unfunded work that still needs to be done. At $3.6 million a year in 20 years, we would have a backlog of about $20 million worth of projects that still needed preventive treatment. At $4 million a year, that would be half, which is currently where we are right now. We still have a $10 million backlog. If we had the money right now, we could spend $10 million on street repairs. And, of course, the bad one there is at the present $150,000 per year, we would have an unmet need, a deferred, of $163 million.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'll go back there. I just had a couple other things that I wanted to add, and then if you have any questions. I've been the operations supervisor for the city for the last 6 years and have taken great pride in the way that our staff has been able to keep ahead of things by analyzing and looking for cheaper, faster, better ways to do things. And one of the things we've been able to accomplish is to minimize the kinds of numbers of calls and complaints that we've gotten over the years. In fact, over the last two or three, we rarely ever get a call with someone reporting in a pothole because we're out there analyzing the system. We know what's where the problems are, and we're trying to patch them up and take care of them as best we can. That was all fine and dandy until about 2 years ago, I should say, maybe 1 year. The calls have started to increase. We are seeing more deterioration. We're unable to keep up with it, as I've shown you in this chart here. So we're starting to feel that pain. And another example is when we do have a pothole complaint, we have actually had a claim reported where vehicles have been damaged and have had to pay those out, something we've never experienced before. So things are definitely a little different these days.
John, would you say that the this picture you're painting here is the city streets in Gresham, I assume?
Yes, sir.
Is this typical of city streets, other cities throughout Oregon, would you say?
Mr. Chair, as far, yes, I'm pretty sure. What I read in the paper and what I see on websites is that a lot of other cities are suffering the same thing. I understand the city of Eugene is anticipating needing approximately $9 million a year, I believe, for local streets. Tigard, a million, something like that. So, and from our meetings with our cooperative agencies, we're hearing the same thing.
I know it causes that alligator striping effect. It's age, and I could disrobe and prove it, but I don't think our committee is ready for that.
Your substructures failed.
and the next chart you do, don't do it all up the way to 2021. I won't be here. Do something that's going to happen in my lifetime. Rubber chips. Where do you get those rubber chips that are used in the road? Do we use recyclable Oregon tires? Or do you know? Or am I asking the wrong question?
That material is usually a latex that the contractors provide, and it's a.
Do we get it here?
Well,
go ahead,
Chairman Brown, Representative Zahner. The rubberized is a newly evolving field. He's correct. Some of it is latex manufactured. Some of it is there's firms in notably Arizona who gather chip tires from all over the nation and then manufacture it and bring it back. Every couple years it seems like as we're trying to find a different manufacturer to produce that. It's a good effective product, but it's still new, and it's what I tell you that is happening now may not be what is happening in 2 years.
I asked the question because we have trouble getting rid of our tires. We're trying to recycle them, and so why don't we chip them here and use them? Seems sensible, but maybe I'm screwed up, but that's nothing. One other question. Do we actually know how much damage steel studs do to our roads? Actually, no. Or that in a later presentation.
Okay. Do you want to
know? Closer?
Thanks. It really, to a certain extent, boils down in how you define damage. I believe the cost allocation study that's been recently done has come up with a number that is around, someone can holler a number at me, but it's in the neighborhood of $10 million. The definition in that case is how much money are we spending to fix the damage. Now, the catch with that question is what happens. You go out there and there's a lot of roads that have ruts, but we didn't pave them any sooner than we would have because of other stress that was happening on the pavement. Therefore, when we say how much money are we spending to fix it, well, we're not spending any additional money. But the fact is you had the ruts out there that with all the negative impacts of the ruts, but we didn't actually spend extra money. Most of the additional money that is being spent is in the high-volume urban areas is where we actually are having to spend money sooner. It is primarily on the state system, but there are a few urban routes in both cities and counties that also have to do overlays sooner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, if I could also answer that question. As was indicated here, we spend about $11 million a year dealing with rut repair on our highways throughout the state. The actual damage is about $50 million a year. So equivalent to about 2 pennies worth of gas tax and associated direct white mile could be used to repair that damage. And while on the lower volume roads, that's not an issue. On our interstates, it drives me nuts that pavements that could last maybe 30 years out there, we're needing to go in and do some sort of repair to deal with the safety
problems are created as a result of ruts from both pulling the vehicles around and also obviously ponding water. But we clearly are not investing adequate dollars to keep up with the damage. I just want to make that clear for the committee.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. If we didn't have them, would we save about $10 million a year? Is that kind of your guess? Is that the way I read it?
What I would say is we would eliminate the need to expend about $10 million a year. That's correct, that we're currently spending now on ruts.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Andrea?
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up on your question earlier in terms of the city of Gresham being representative of cities across the state. I think John can speak for the counties, and he'll be getting to some numbers next. But to answer your question, yes, everywhere from Ontario to this side of the mountains, the average deficiency of our maintenance and preservation needs in cities is over 50%. Some vary slightly, but this is a very good picture of what you're going to see statewide.
Thank you. Any other questions? Let's see, where are we at in the presentation? I think we're up
okay.
To John.
Right now you're at page 73. We do have one slide that was out of order. You probably noticed that we went flying by it earlier. If you sort of hold your finger on 73, go back to page 54. There's a chart that is now up there that's annual maintenance preservation unmet needs in millions. Couple points off this slide. This lack of money for maintenance is a system-wide problem. It exists within ODOT. It exists within the counties. It exists within the cities. You take a look at the top ones where it says total maintenance preservation needs. This is based on several studies that have been done that says on a urban street you need to spend this much money, so we take the number of those miles in the state. A rural collector under a certain ADT, if it's paved, you got to do this amount of money. If it's a gravel one, you got to do this amount of money. So it's basically on those things, on studies that were done primarily out of Washington State, we came up with what the appropriate need was. Then we went out and saw how much money we were spending. And out of that, you come up with that unmet need. If you do the arithmetic, what you find is we're only spending about 50% of what we should be spending. Say it again. We're only spending about 50% of what we should be spending. Now, flip back to 73. What is it we're talking about in maintenance and preservation? As we listen to folks, we find out that, well, there's certain things that we all know, they all know we're doing, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that when we say, oh, we're doing that, they say, oh, yeah. I'd like to walk you through those. Page 73, you got the pavement repairs. You saw some of the discussion, you know, where you got the pothole patching, the small area patching, inlay patching. There's got to be 20 major ways of doing patching out there. It all depends on the type of pavement, how bad it was before you got to it. Pavement preservation, once again, John was giving this presentation. It's the crack sealing and the seal coats and the overlays. This is the stuff you do to keep the thing from totally falling apart. And if you do it soon, you save yourself a lot of money. Everyone sort of expects that pretty fast.
John?
Yes.
That very first screen that you showed us, it was roughly $1 billion a year in maintenance to just maintain this?
We should be spending about $1 billion a year to maintain our system. Okay. Have it in a slide later. Our system is worth about $50 billion. That would be spending about 2% to maintain and preserve the system. Okay. Is what we should be spending.
Represent Dave Mabry.
Can I follow up on that? Going back to page 2, you don't have to go back there. Take my word for it. It says that counties have maybe three times the many road miles as cities do. But looking at this chart, counties don't even have twice the number of dollar needs as cities do. Is that because of the different standards of typically county roads are maybe not as wide and have gravel shoulders and those kind of things as opposed to curbs and gutters?
Chairman Brown, Representative Mabry, yes, that's correct. I mean, some of the obvious, you think of a city that's an urban street, curbs, tight about storm drains. When you get the county, now we have some of those roads, but a lot of our roads, in fact, are even gravel roads, but you don't take as high a dollar level of maintenance.
I have a follow-up question to that. Does that include, I know that, and I have done a lot of work on culvert replacement. Those maintenance costs for cities and counties include culvert replacement, and also I know that you have in here some of the work that you do on a regular basis, but
Those numbers would include replacements. Frankly, from the numbers we grabbed, it probably doesn't cover the additional costs associated with making those replacements fish-friendly. But it would cover the cost of a basic replacement.
Okay. Thank you.
Continuing maintenance activities, what we go under the title of roadside features. I mean, we have to go out there and grade the shoulders. You have to mow the shoulders. That's both a safety issue and a drainage issue. Hazardous tree removal. This isn't just the ones about ready to fall on the road, especially when you get in your rural system. You've got a lot of branches out there, things hanging in front of you. The school bus drivers don't like it when their windshields get taken out. You've got to get out and clear those things back. Brushing, once again, visibility issues. Noxious weed control, extremely important in the agricultural areas, that these noxious weeds that form in our right-of-ways don't spread into the fields adjacent. Sweeping bike pedestrian paths, you can have them constructed, but if you don't take care of them, they're not usable. Litter pickup, graffiti removal. If you don't do it, you're just not being a good neighbor with your adjacent property owners. Fence repairs, mailbox supports and repairs, there's a lot of them out there, and they have to be maintained. In theory, it is done by the adjacent property owner. In practice, there is often the expectation that we take care of it, and we tend to do what the people expect us to do. Continuing maintenance activities, traffic services. We have a lot of signs out there, and they're not cheap. And we have to keep them up to advise people, to let them know what they need to be going and where they need to be going. Paint striping, extremely expensive operation, in most cases has to be done every year unless you go with some new innovative technologies that are quite expensive. There's appropriate places for them, but mostly it is the once-a-year painting is what's happening out there. All the crosswalks, railroad crossings, traffic lights, signals, they're all over, and they are not inexpensive to maintain. It takes highly technical, competent people, a lot of computers and a lot of those things, hard to keep up. Street lighting, especially in the urban areas, very high expectation that our roads need to be visible, especially when you have the pedestrians and so forth. All those nice old centerline reflectors that are out there, do you look nice? And, you know, if you've ever been on a rainy road that you're used to having those reflectors and then they're not there anymore, you really miss them. They're not cheap. Guardrails. Now, this, if you're replacing a guardrail, we tend to put that in the modernization side and so forth, but just to keep up the rails, I said that wrong. Replacement tends to be in something we have to do. If it's there, if it fails, it gets old, we need to replace it. They don't last forever. Also, whenever there's an accident happens, we need to get out and replace in a hurry, because by virtue of the fact that someone hit it, means you probably need it back up there again in a hurry. Concrete barriers, especially a lot of the state system, they have these crash attenuators, you know, things that collapse and so forth. Really good. Save lives almost every time they're hit. Extremely expensive to replace.
May I ask a question, sir?
Yes.
Are sidewalks included in that... In your maintenance activities, roadside features, and the city,
I didn't say
the amount of money,
list, but yes,
in the dollar needs, there also includes sidewalk yes. maintenance in that.
Yes, when I would have come up with that needs, it would have included urban sidewalks. Bridges, well, we talked about the cost to replace them, but you also have to maintain them, or they don't last. We do biannual bridge inspections. Every other year, every single bridge in this state is inspected by a certified bridge inspector. That is all audited and tracked through ODOT for even the local agency bridges to make sure that we do not have a bridge out there that is failing that we don't know about. Vitally important to do, expensive. A lot of day-to-day, just cleaning, painting, removing the drift at the piers. Of course, we have a few bridges that are extremely expensive, your drawbridges and so forth. Snow and ice. Now, this will vary from year to year, different parts of the state, but basically there's a lot of snow and ice work out there, sanding, anti-icing materials, drainage. You got other storm drains out there, silt gathers in it, you have to clean it, catch basins have to be clean, culverts got to be cleaned, often they plug, you got to clean them, ditches.
especially in the rural areas, you know, a ditch doesn't stay a ditch unless from time to time you go through and clean it. It's a slow, laborious process, but you've got to go do it. Environmentally, that is getting to be real expensive because a lot of things that you used to be able to do, we can no longer do. We have found, we meaning the environmental community, but we support, that there's certain activities where basically we did a lot of that work in the middle of winter because it was so easy because, hey, the water helped us wash the silt away and keep things cleaned up and working. We found out maybe that wasn't so useful for the fish, so we're having to change and come up with a lot of pollution control as we do this. It adds money, but it's important. Storm repairs, most of you know I was Kalama County Director of Public Works for 18 years. There's a lot of money associated with cleaning up after a storm. Just a lot of trees down, a lot of slides down, just things you have to replace. So that's sort of the list. It was by no means inclusive of everything we do, but this is all the stuff that everyone just expects to happen. They don't think of it as a project. They don't go out and say, hey, let's have a bonding package for this. But it's stuff you got to do, and we've got to pay for it. Oregonians have made a substantial investment in our system. I referred earlier, this system, if you tried to replace it, it would take about $50 billion to replace this system. Right now we're spending about 1% on maintaining that. We should be spending about 2%. There has been no increase in state funding for maintenance in over a decade. Now what's been happening out there at the state, at the counties, at the cities, we have been scrounging and scrambling and getting more and more efficient, but the demand is just growing faster than we can do that. Just not getting there. What do Oregonians lose if we don't do the adequate roadside maintenance and preservation? Obviously, business, industry, quality of life will suffer. If the roads aren't there, you're beating up your equipment, you're not being able to travel as fast. It's just not as nice to drive down a Chuck Holly road as a good road. Moving the goods and services, once again, if you don't have the good roads in good condition, your trucks are not getting through freely and so forth. Emergency repairs, this especially applies to your drainage. You know, if you don't keep your drainage up, all of a sudden you lose a major piece of road, or you get a piece that goes into major chuck holes in a hurry. Side issue, if you can see it out on county roads real easy, you'll be driving down the road and be chuck holy a while and then nice for a while and chuck holy for a while and nice for a while. You go back and look at it again and it's directly related to whether the ditches were there or not. Real common occurrence. Might do that sometime if you're wondering, just nothing else to do. In the end, the taxpayers do pay for lack of maintenance. They pay for it in additional costs to their vehicles, typically, and additional time to get things done. And the other one that it's so hard to identify it specifically, but if you don't do the maintenance right, you have an increase in accidents. Chuck holes cause accidents. Ruts on the side of the road cause accidents. Bad sight distance by lack of brushing cause accidents. People die out there if you don't get the maintenance done. Final summary. Having to do with everything we've been talking about this morning that says, you know, if you don't get the modernization projects done, if you don't get the bridges done, if you don't take care of the maintenance of your existing system, we lose. Our strong transportation system is the backbone of the economy. There's lots of other things needed for the economy, but if you don't have the transportation, you're not going to get there either. Spending money in transportation on straight job creation. About every $1 million you spend, you generate about 19 jobs. And that applies to whether you're doing it with construction projects or with maintenance. You still got about the same ratios of people to materials out there. You generate jobs when you spend money for transportation. A little thing on the bit, since I'm doing maintenance and preservation, understand that money put in maintenance transportation will actually be on the ground money spent probably faster than anything else you can fund. There's my pitch for maintenance press. Questions?
Any questions? John?
I don't know that this is a question or a comment, but I suppose it's a question statewide. In Wasco County, when I first became county commissioner, we were modernizing some county roads just about every year. We had enough money. Of course, that's when we had timber sales, too. But we had enough money to convert gravel roads into paved roads from time to time. Not huge amounts, but nonetheless we were getting there. And then as dollars got tighter, we no longer were doing road renewals. We were just barely doing maintenance. And now we're in a mode of some of those paved roads are reverting back to gravel roads because we don't have the money to maintain them. It's a serious problem, I know, in a good share of my district. I assume it's the same over on this side of the mountain.
Chairman Brown, Representative Mabry, Wasco County is not the only jurisdiction having that problem. There are many.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I got a few. I'm working with the Bicycle Alliance people now to sweep bike paths, so I have yet to see one of the sweepers out there working the St. Paul and all through that area that I ride now. Representative Dingfeller rides a bicycle also, so but how often do they sweep the bike paths? Because all the junk is right there on the bike paths when I ride them. Good question. Take that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative's Honor, we try to maintain the roadways properly. I think the level of service is always, again, beholder, to the eye of the beholder. I don't know the exact schedules, but which we do the actual sweeping. We do sweeping on a regular basis, but also we try to go out on another or even more regular basis, pick up trash and large pieces of debris that are out there. I would suspect that we're probably not doing an adequate job for what the bike community thinks we need to be doing out there. But we are; those are some of the monies that we do collect from the 1% for bikes. As you know, the state law requires us to spend that. So that deals with not only construction but also maintenance and preservation. So I guess if you have an area where we're not doing a good job, we need to know about it. And the state maintenance engineer is in the audience today, and I'm sure he'd love to chat with you about where some of those areas would be. But I depending on the roadway, the regularity it really needs to coincide with the debris and the type of usage of the roadway. Long answer, but I apologize.
And I wasn't being critical. The Bicycle Alliance is willing to license bicycles and pay a fee so that we can get that done, and I'm working with them on that. So, I mean, I do have a couple questions around Hershberger Motors in Woodburn. There's a big lot that's controlled by ODOT that's rarely mowed. He mows it himself, in fact. And I've tried to get ODOT to give him permission to mow it if he could park a few of his trucks on that piece of ground when the company stores when the company stores have their overflow, because then he moves some of the he'd like to move a few of his medium sized things that he sells over in that field. He'll keep it clean, and yet we can't do it. ODOT is demanding that he pay a lease fee to do that when we're not mowing the damn thing to start with, and it's just flat driving me nuts. So I don't want to put you on the spot, but that doesn't make sense to me. And it would help the company stores because they have an overflow problem, and they could move some of their vehicles into Hershberger's lot, which is right across the street. And you want to respond to that, Bruce?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Honor, I sure can respond to that. We obviously would like to see people like that have beneficial use of a property if we're not needing it for, you know, active right-of-way or road purposes. The Constitution that we have and the laws that you've passed supporting the Constitution require us to essentially make sure that the Highway Trust Fund investments are not being used for other things that are not intended for Highway Trust Fund. And frankly, we need to recover market value and rates for the use of those properties to reimburse the Highway Trust Fund for essentially that investment. We also are willing to take, however, into account services that we might receive from individuals utilizing that property as a credit on their side of the equation. So when those occasions occur, we do a market analysis of what you know that property would lease at if it was on the private market, but also then give credits for things like you're talking about in terms of mowing and taking care of that property. And if you got a particular one, maybe we can figure out where that is. It sounds like there's some history on this one, and the bottom line is, without some constitutional and law changes, we would not be able to just grant free use of that property to adjacent property owners.
One follow-up. You won't miss it if you go out there. You've got Arby's, which is beautifully landscaped, and you've got the company stores in Hershberger and all that area, which was forced to do all that beautiful landscaping, and then you got that one piece of ground that is owned by the citizens of the state and managed by ODOT that has weeds up to the armpits, and so you can't miss it out there. And now with the restrictions on money, the mowing's going to be cut down to maybe once a year. You know, it's our responsibility to keep that area looking nice if we're controlling that property. And
good suggestion.
Miss it if you go out there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up on Representative Zahner's question. I'm sorry, I don't think I put my name on the record earlier. Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. Some of the issues you're talking about with street sweeping and mowing, et cetera, I can tell you that there are cities that have basically had to end some of those programs because of the lack of dollars for maintenance and preservation. And unfortunately, some of those are the first things to go or either be severely cut back so that they can triage some of the real safety issues that are occurring because we're not maintaining and preserving our roads. Just a little perspective there.
John, I had a question. Your one slide showed that it was almost $1 billion required to do the maintenance on the roadways for each year. If we're only spending $500 million, which I think another slide showed there, then we're accumulating $500 million in back maintenance. Does that have an accumulative effect like it did on the bridges, where apparently it's caught up with us now?
Chairman Brown, a major portion of that does have accumulated. There's pieces, obviously, that don't. I mean, if you stop sweeping, well, you can start sweeping again and you haven't lost that much. But if you're not doing your pavement preservation work, if you're not doing your drainage, to a great extent your brushing and tree limbing, those things will get ahead of you if you don't stay with it. And so, yes, a major portion of that is, in fact, accumulated work out there that needs to be done.
Any other questions? Thank you, folks, for the program today. Really appreciate it.
Good job.
Did we have be up there, right? Anything else, Janet?
I want to share a couple things at your place that are either previous or coming up.
Okay.
For the record, if you see the name Merwin Greenleck, that's just an AKA for Mitch Greenleck.
I thought it was a relative or something.
If there's nothing else, we'll be adjourned.